Oh, I know you've straightened it or something. It looks lovely.
Oh, wait, that's because I have to go and see. Actually.
You have to leave the house.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Oh, it looks great. You look fantastic.
There's a filter on there.
Oh. Hi, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Sarah. And welcome to
Good Luck with the Book. The podcast that celebrates all things books with plenty of news, stories and chats. Welcome back. It's episode 6 of the podcast, and we're both here again, Sarah and myself. Woo! Stressed off our heads, so busy with like life starting to reopen. Sarah's hair is very did today, first time in a year.
I'm back in the public eye, which is...
Actually, mine is quite did as well.
Yeah, it is. That's because you've got a reading tomorrow.
Oh, yes, of course I do. Yes. A court event is on, so I'm going to be doing that. So by the time this goes out on Friday, I'll have done it.
But are you reading from your new book?
No, I'm reading from the novel. So I actually have to find 700 words to read out of it. So I read a piece a couple of weeks ago for another online event, which kind of went down well, which was because in Dubai, they have these things on Friday called, they're Friday brunches, but it's like a Roman feast.
Oh, Jamie, I've been to one.
They're insane. They're like insane. You've never seen anything like it. It's like a buffet on absolute steroids, like a buffet extreme. So I actually
Rooms
read...
Rooms of food.
Yeah. Because the challenge with reading a piece out of a novel is when you have to explain the scene to the audience, you lose them. And it's actually finding something that is just snappy and needs very little explanation.
Stand alone.
Yeah. So it's just a scene where Trevor, who's the main character in the book, is standing in front of a cake stand with like 70 cakes and he's just trying to pick out what cake he's going to have, and he's having like that kind of over choice, like when we have too much choice and he's kind of paralyzed by it.
Choice anxiety.
Yeah. And I just, you know, it was a big trick that Ina Blyton used to do was she put loads of food into her books because kids love it. You know, ginger ale and lashings of ginger ale and all that kind of stuff, because actually it really catches kids' attention when there's food in books. As it turns out, adults are exactly the same. And that's why we buy cookbooks, and that's why we do everything. So I was like, you know what? Cheap win. It'll do. How's your week been? Have you watched anything good on the television?
I haven't even watched any television. I literally come home, go up to the... Because I've got all my assignments are due in next weekend. So I come home and go up to the attic, and I'm up there most nights this week till 11:30, 12:30.
And you have two kids as well on top of that.
Well, they've hardly ever seen me. Pearl wakes up during the night screaming, "Mama!"
Oh, the poor baby.
I just got some subbing hours in the school, so it just
extra
means
work.
I have to prepare more lessons, plus my assignments, plus my lessons that I already do, and then bring up a family. So, you know, it's great.
You have it all. Is that what they say? You have it all. So,
but it's really good experience, you know, so I'll take it.
Now, I'm going to apologize.
What about you?
No, I've been really, really busy. So the course that I have been preparing for the last year to teach is going to go live from the start of July. So the website is going to be updated with that. So it's going to be a advanced fiction course for those who are very serious about writing. So it's kind of drawing on kind of the masters and the MFA. So it's going to,
Brilliant.
And also with a couple of master classes on publishing. So I'm going to get some publishing people into the course. So it's actually a lot of work involved in that because I want it to be the best course out there in this space. So it's a lot of kind of research and a lot of, because I'm creating content and course booklets and everything. So it's a very big
Intense.
Project. Yeah, so I've been busy every day. And do you know what? John's been away kind of working a lot. So I've just had my time at home very lasered. But between all that, I've actually watched, you know, The Job Lot? It's actually on Netflix. It was out a couple of years ago. So it's kind of like The Office-y, but it's set in kind of a Dole office in the UK. It's very good. It's very good. Yeah, it's a bit of a laugh. Like, now, it's not brilliant, but it's very good.
Jamie, do you watch The American Office?
Bits of it. I find it quite hard to watch.
Yeah, you find it hard to watch?
Just cringy. I find cringy stuff really hard to watch.
Well, that's the thing about The American Office is I went back and rewatched The Office, and I actually found it very, you know, he's so horrible. He's just a horrible person. Yeah. Whereas Michael Scott in the American one, his heart's kind of in the right place. Sometimes you feel like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening watching the English one. But the American one, oh, he actually really liked it. He's kind of warm. Yeah. That's what I watched when I had,
when you had a life.
Do you know what I did watch actually is the robbery one about the art robbery in Boston. Watch that. This is the robbery.
John has been watching that. Yeah, I have just kind of maxed out on those true crime Netflix things, so I kind of left him at it. So he generally goes upstairs to watch it, and I'd be downstairs reading or whatever. And, well, actually not reading, watching, I've started watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer again, back from the beginning. Times are tough, there's nothing left to watch. The one thing I did see was back on, which I can actually just, this should be, can I just say really for me this week? However,
do you want to say this?
No, we'll go for it. Naked Attraction is a show that shouldn't exist.
Jamie.
Firstly, where do they find these people? But it's back on and it's so
disturbing.
Awful. It's awful. I find it, everything that's wrong with television. It's so unappealing. It's like the worst kind of voyeurism, or I don't even know. I find it really bizarre. Don't understand where they find these people who are happy to be unveiled naked from the ankles going up. I find it.
Yeah, because you know, even like there is nothing more unattractive than seeing a man in a t-shirt with no boxers walking across the floor. Like, it's okay the other way around, but it's so, it's just.
I find in most cases, unless you're kind of in the humor yourself and you overlook a lot of things, very few people in that sort of bleached light of a studio are going to look any good. Oh my God, I just, maybe it just triggers something in myself. The idea of being observed that sort of naked in such a brutal way is just like, I don't understand how these people aren't like, if I was told like, you have to go on that show because it's either that or like a bullet to the brain, I'd be like, just give me like 6 months and I'll just go on keto and like work out. It would just be, do you know what I mean? I couldn't do it. I don't, but maybe these people are just that comfortable with their bodies, but it's a weird way to date. It's such a weird concept.
Yeah, why do you need to tell the world about it? Like, go to a nudist beach or something. You don't need to.
But it's always the people on the nudist beach. It's always like the 55-year-old creepy man. Like, it's never the like hot young fella. It's, or the hot young one.
Jared did. Did you ever hear of that photographer Spencer Tunick? And he takes pictures of like groups of naked people. So, and they're from a distance. It looks.
They did one
like,
in Cork. Actually, yeah, they did. Yeah.
Yeah. So it looks like, look, people look like sheep sometimes, or the one Dara did was at Dollymount Strand. It was the same time he did the Cork one. So he came to Ireland, Dara and his friend Daryl did it.
They did it?
So, yeah, they did it.
Oh my God.
They're collected like at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then you're not told where you're going to be brought. And they were brought off to Dollymount Strand. And then he said you had to bend down.
Oh my God. It gets worse. So,
but then you got everyone who did it got assigned like limited edition print, and you're in it, obviously, you try and spot yourself. So we have Spencer Chernick up in the attic with naked Dara up there somewhere.
Oh my God.
One of my friends was so pissed off because the lads didn't tell him. He was like, I wanted to do it. He would have done it.
I find that truly terrifying because I know a couple of people in Cork who did it. It actually was in Blarney Castle, I think, at the time.
Yeah, Blarney Castle was, and they held a flower up. That's what it was. Ray Darcy did it there.
Ray Darcy did it?
Yeah, he did it. I remember he went down at the show. Dara said, it's really weird at the start, but then everyone's just naked. It doesn't matter. Said like,
but like, what if you're a man and it's like a really cold day?
But it was a really cold day. He said nobody is like, what they're done is like, they met at like dawn. So it was like in between darkness. It was cold, early morning cold. But he said it was like, nobody cares anymore. Suddenly everyone's just the same. It's like you're all standing there in clothes. He said he'd be surprised how quick it goes from feeling really odd to just feeling normal.
I suppose, I'm trying to think, I've never done naked like that, but
no,
like I've been to like Circuit Party, which is kind of a gay summer party. It's actually a water park that's just taken over for like a big gay kind of disco or whatever. But like people are wearing water park gear, so they were like wearing Speedos, and of course all the Irish wear shorts and stuff because they can't cope with Speedos at all. But you know, it's a lot of almost fully naked people. But I suppose it's a different thing where I'd say 80% of the people there like have a six pack. So I don't know on that day that I was there that I ever really forgot the fact that I was woefully inadequate as a human being.
Jamie, you have a six pack.
I don't have a six pack. No, I work out a way. It's fine, but yeah. You know. Oh, I have a story from last week. So okay, I went on the Daniel Davey program. Actually, amazing book. Eat Up, Raise Your Game. It was out by Gill last year. Really good book. He's the nutritionist for the Dublin football team and I think the Leinster rugby team. Really good book. And it's all very kind of calorific in the way. It's just calorie deficit really, but kind of very healthily done. So I started last week, and on Monday I'm allowed up to about 2,000 calories a day. I just thought, nice little bring down a couple of kilos with summer approaching and lockdown ending. And I was never hitting the 2,000 in the day. Like Monday was about 1,700, Tuesday was 1,600, and I was fine. I wasn't particularly hungry. but my weight went up.
What?
I couldn't understand it. So I'd like, I weighed myself on Friday and I was like, I'm kind of up a kilo, like by eating half. Anyway, as it turns out, because I was going, this just makes no sense. Like, I really do believe calorie deficit is king. And as it turns out, I was the porridge I was having for breakfast, which was 436 calories. As it turns out, the portion he actually does is for two that you're supposed to split in two. So I was actually having 900 calories for breakfast before I'd even started the day of porridge. Like, now the bowl was mounted up.
900 calories of porridge?
No, because it was porridge with cranberries and honey and coconut flakes. And so it was beautiful. It was so tasty. And I was like, gosh.
Your bowl?
Oh, no, it was quite full. I was kind of like, God, that's a lot for 434 calories. But you know, I should have questioned it because my head did go, this seems like amazing.
And I was, but how many going, grams of oats was it?
It was 100 grams of oats.
Jamie! Like, it's like, I think it's like 30 to 40 grams you have of oats.
Yeah, no, no.
100 grams of oats?
I think I looked at it, I was like, I had a pizza for breakfast every day. Like, I was going, the pizza I had on Saturday had the same calories as my breakfast every day last week. So my weight went up. So I'm absolutely bulling. I haven't stopped talking about it for about 3 days. John's like, shut up now, you need to move on.
I can't even begin. How big is your bowl? Like, how
well, it was kind of mounted up. Anyway, Sarah, we're going to get on to books because we have an interview today with Emma Gleeson, who is the author of Stuff Happens. So Emma is a consultant for people who are trying to kind of clear out. She has a business called Give Up Your Old Things, and her book is amazing. And we had a really good interview the other week. So that interview is probably about 20 minutes. So we'll have to move on, get on to that. however, I did want to flag a couple of things because I was reading. There's one called All the Young Men by Ruth Coker Burks, who wrote a book about gay men in the 80s. So she was a young woman. I think she's in her mid-20s. She was visiting a friend in hospital and she's from Arkansas. So very kind of conservative Bible Belt part of the US. And when she was there, it was, I think, mid-80s, there just was a load of food waiting outside a room with like the hazard stickered across the door. And the nurses were taking like bets to see who would have to go into the room and serve the food. And she was like, what's going on there? She hadn't heard of HIV or anything like that. And as it turns out, there was a young man in the bed. She went in and helped him when the nurses wouldn't. And he was in the final few hours before he died. So she ended up staying there, I think, for 17 hours till he finally died. And whatever way it kind of moved her was the hospital then rang her again when other gay men came up. And I think over the course of the next sort of 5 or 6 years, she was essentially a sort of an informal hospice for about 40 or 50 gay men who were kicked out by their families but had HIV and were dying, and the families wanted nothing to do with them and none of the hospitals would have anything to do with them. And it's an incredible story. Like, she was rooting through dumpsters and stuff for food. Like, it's an incredible account. I saw her, she was interviewed for Damien Barr's Saloon, you know, the literary saloon in the UK. Yeah. And it was an incredible hour.
Well, Damien Barr is the one that wrote the Maggie and Me.
Maggie and Me, exactly. Yeah. So the book is incredible. I actually,
and what's it called?
It's called All the Young Men.
All the Young
it's
Men.
It's so good. She is just one of those rare people in a million who has a gift for kindness. It's such an incredible account. So Sarah, do you have a featured children's book this week? Now, I know I haven't read to your kids this week because you've been so busy.
Dara is reading to them. Okay. Right, it's a gorgeous book. It's from the O'Brien Press. It's from Erica McGann and Jerry Daly, and it's called Where Are You Puffling? Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling?
I didn't. Oh, I've seen the cover of that book. It's
it's
cute.
Gorgeous.
It's actually, I think it's one of the nicest books they've done ever, like, for kids. It's really, really stunning.
It's so cute, and it's just a little story. It's set in the Skellig Islands as well, so it's great for like just getting a little flavor of Ireland. And it's all about little puffin goes missing. A baby puffin called a puffling goes missing, and his parents are trying to find him, and it's really, really cute. So,
do you know what? We'll all be staycationing soon.
Yeah.
Harry will be busy. It's a great one to bring back actually for kids.
Yeah,
if you'd like
really
a niece or nephew or something like that. It's actually a gorgeous book. I have seen that one, I have to say.
And what's cuter than a puffling?
Oh, I know, puffling. They're like little balls of fluff. Now, I was out on the, because I went out to the Skelligs with, I've been out there about 4 years ago, and it was one of those real perfect days of the sun spilling the stones, clear blue sky, and they're gorgeous. They're just like sitting.
Oh, did you see them?
Oh my God, yeah, they're just there. Like, they're actually quite tame because obviously they're quite safe out there. So the puffins are just hanging around really, really close. So it's very, very special. Now, I think to get out to the Skelligs, I'd be keeping an eye out right now for tickets going live, because I said they'll go live as soon as the government announces some sort of open thing. And normally it's, they're like concert tickets to get out there. I think they're only allowed to bring out maybe just 100 people a day out there. It's really low numbers. So if you want to get out there, you need to be, it's like getting a ticket to go see Beyonce or something.
Yeah,
you
have
to be,
well, it's the UNESCO Heritage site, so it's
Very limited. I think they're only allowed to bring out maybe 10 boats or something a day. It's a very strict number of people allowed out on the islands. So our featured interview today is for Stuff Happens, as we said, by Emma Gleeson. She was incredible. So we might as well just get straight away tucked in. So we're delighted today to be introducing Emma Gleeson about her new book, Stuff Happens. Life is messy and sometimes so is your space. As a reformed hoarder, turned professional, declutterer, Emma Gleeson knows it is easy to be overwhelmed by stuff. Stuff Happens is a life-changing guide to tackling chaos and letting go of perfection. It is full of practical advice on what to keep and what to chuck responsibly. I suppose just to, before we even start, you've set up your own business, Give Up Your Old Things. Love it. Just if you want to talk us through your kind of journey to hear how you kind of started out in fashion, because it really informs the book, actually. I read it. I was like, I really feel I'm reading a book about somebody who understands material cultures.
Speaking of Give Up Your Old Things, I got a message from someone on my Facebook, which I so rarely check. And she was like, I'm a message from California. Can you explain to me what owl tings means? And I was like, yes, of course, Catherine. So material culture is bet into everything that I do, because I have a master's in the history and culture of fashion, which is basically fashion for nerds. We were the nerds in the fashion college who didn't make anything. We just looked at things. And sometimes we touched them, but mostly we read about them. And my dissertation that I wrote as part of that master's was about the psychology of fast fashion and the effect of consumer culture on young female consumers. So what you read there, the description of the book you read there, is only really a third of the book. You know, it's a huge part of the book is about consumer culture, what underpins our shopping compulsions, and why the clutter gets into the house in the first place. Because I just think it's just the elephant in the room when we talk about clutter. You know, shopping is the elephant in the room. And how the stuff, if you don't look at how the stuff is getting into the house in the first place, you are just going to be caught in this clutter cycle. But I'm also, you know, you mentioned material culture. I'm also coming at this from like a love of things and like an understanding that there's no human society ever recorded that has not expressed itself through its material culture, you know, wanted to adorn its body. So, you know, I exist in the sustainability realm, and often the baby's thrown out with the bathwater there when it's like, you know, all possessions are corrupting and evil. But I'm finding the balance. Like, I'm not a minimalist, and people are always kind of surprised to hear that. I don't live in like a plain white apartment with a single sad cactus. I'm a lover of things, and the core of the book is about getting people to fall back in love with the stuff that they own, to look after it, to really value it, to have it enhance their life instead of hamper it. You know, so many of us are in this, like I said, this cycle of like doing a clear out every 6 months, and it's bananas. You're wasting so much money. You're causing yourself so much stress. You're having to tidy up constantly. I'm just like, there's nothing to lose here from what I'm trying to tell you to do. Follow me.
But it kind of all just reappears. Like every time I do a clear out, I come back 6 months later and it's just, and I don't even know how it's reappeared. It's like it's literally breeding in the cupboards, like t-shirts like breeding.
The opposite
t-shirts.
Of socks. Yeah.
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 Funny enough, Sarah and I were talking just before you came on call. I think I get an A, actually, but actually, even just talking to you there, I'm actually suddenly dropping myself to a B for in terms of clutter, because I'm really not, having traveled a lot and just so many times, just I don't have that attachment to stuff. But Sarah, you are not like that.
Oh, like it comes from my mom, and just reading your book, it's really interesting, because kind of, you kind of go into like the psychology and sociology of why we keep stuff, and it kind of made me be kinder about the way I think about my mom's clutter. I'm just like, throw it away. So when I moved out there, I kind of brought clutter with me and kept clutter because that's what I came from, I suppose. But now my husband is like completely anti-clutter. So I've got much better at decluttering. But still, like just when I was reading your book, I was thinking, I don't have that much clutter in the bathroom. Then I read your bathroom chapter. I was like, oh my God, I have all tiny little bottles of crap that I'm never going to use.
Sorry.
And just everything. I was like, oh, I am quite bad.
And the hotel little bottles, because now we can only bring those little 100 mils, I always just take it all from the hotel. And I'm now like looking at, that's one thing I do have clutter actually. I have a little box of like little mini shampoos from the hotels that I've stayed at over the years, going, they'll be handy now one day when I probably fly again.
No, like, when will they be handy?
They'll be handy is my most loathed.
Yes.
Will they be? No. I have a friend who like, she laughs that, like, the book is a direct personal attack at her, because she's just like, she is my greatest muse and my greatest nemesis, and she is like a hoarder of, like, yeah, makeup samples and moisturizer samples, and yeah, handy, but then we joke about it, but if there's something deeper there, like, this is a deep thing, and we want to have resources that we need, and like, it makes sense to want to have shampoo for when you go on holidays, but it's just that there's so much coming in, because there is just such an abundance of stuff available to us. You know, the middle aisles in our middle have a lot to answer for. My husband and I were laughing the other day because there are so many inflatable kayaks on adverts now, and it's because they were available in one, either Aldi or Lidl, and people used them once and were like, I hate this, and now they're all up on adverts. Oh, it just makes me laugh, but also obviously is very depressing. Yeah. But no, it's we joke about it, but it's so normal. And you know, like you say, oh, I'm terrible. Everyone has this. There's no, like, unless you have a hoarding disorder, which is like, you know, an anxiety problem that you need a psychotherapist for, everybody has this. And that's what I'm trying to say. I think for Irish people as well, and probably for your mom, you might say, you know, there's nothing deep emotional going on here. It's just stuff. But what I'm trying to say in my hopefully kind way is, like, there's actually a lot of deeper stuff going on here. And if you can accept that, then you can move on. Instead of just being like, oh, I can't decide about that. You know, it's nothing to do with an emotion or, a memory. Ah, put it back in the cupboard. What I'm saying is, we can slow down and just pick at what it is that's bothering us about each item. Then you can move on. Yeah.
Because I know when my grandmother died and my grandfather did a bit of a clear out, and I would have been there as an 11-year-old. I would have been quite young at the time, and not really, I keep looking at all this crap on the shelves, like porcelain figurines and all this kind of stuff, which is hideous. But then I kind of look at the stuff I have now, and I don't think I'm particularly a clutter person, but like, I have a few magnets, like, for the fridge and stuff, which I got almost as a joke from like Venice and places like that, and they're hideous. And I'm sure anyone who didn't know the fact that, oh, I got that with John when we were in Venice pre-pandemic, and every time I look at it, even though it's hideous, it does give me a smile to that moment. And I will probably always have it, even though it will always look kitsch and rotten.
But there'll
be some in 50 years time when, you know, whatever, they're weeding me into the home, whatever, and they're going through my stuff. They'll probably look at that and go like, oh, just fuck that in the bin. And I'll be like, well, that was for my first holiday with John, you know. And
I literally had this exact conversation with a friend of mine. She's a curator in Collins Barracks. She's a historian and a curator in one of our national museums. And we had this exact conversation. Like, she is in her, I'd say, late 40s. She has no children. And she collects a lot of souvenirs from her travels. And she's like, this has no meaning to anybody other than me. Like, even my nieces and nephews, who will probably have to, as you say, Jamie, like, when the time comes, have to, you know, execute my estate. It won't mean anything to them. So this is really, that fascinates me, you know, and how things that have no monetary value have meaning, and how you pass on that meaning. Like, you know, Edmund DeWall's book that was a big, The Hair with the Amber Eyes, like, that's such a fascinating look at, like, how objects have meaning and how you can unpick meaning that wasn't there for you, but that was there for your ancestors. Yeah.
It was funny reading that chapter there, because I teach creative writing, and actually your theories on objects is how I teach setting a lot, because I talk about every object has a story attached to it, no matter what it is. Because I'd say, even like, and normally what I do if I'm in a class or whatever, and I'll put something in front of them, usually a chair or something like that, and I go, what's that? And everyone in the room just like freezes, because they're like, this is surely a trick question. And I'm like, it's a chair. I'm like, how do you know it's a chair? And they look at me and they're going, okay. Because at some point in your memory, someone told you that's a chair. So there is a memory attached to that object that gives that object meaning. And that's the only reason why you're able to identify what it is. And then I'd say, like, well, actually, if you were strapped to that chair for 50 years and whipped, and someone said, I'm going to throw that in the bonfire, you'd be like, I'll throw it in with you. Delighted. So not only does the chair have a logical reason for existence, it has an emotional thing, in the sense that if that chair is the chair you sit in front of a table and have a feast of every day for the rest of your life, and someone wants to throw it in the fire, you'll feel a pang at the thought of losing it. Whereas if it's attached to something negative. So objects not only have logical, but they also have sort of an emotional attachment, every object. And so when I'm teaching creative writing, I say to people, look at the objects in the scene and understand that every object has a story, and you can use that to create sort of a magic in stories. And there's amazing books out there like The Gardens of Evening Mists, which really use that to an extreme degree. And it was funny because I read your chapter and I was like, oh my God, in a totally different kind of discipline.
Yeah.
This is the same theory.
Yeah, totally.
Amazing.
That reminds me of my degree was in theatre and drama. And I think we had that exact class, one of my first weeks, it was like, you know, semiotics 101. And I think it was more or less like, what is a chair? You know, how do you present a chair on this? Obviously, we were talking visually on the stage. How do you do it? But that's so interesting. God, it sounds like I'd love to join some of your classes. They sound brilliant.
I know. I was just talking about material culture. I was like, I want to
see
this more.
Because the other thing I was going to ask is, because a big thing, this is a books podcast, books are such a hang up for people. So, you know, there's people out there who haven't obviously read your book yet. So go out and buy it, everyone. But how would you approach books with someone who nearly everyone, that's going to be the thing they get caught on? Probably, well, certainly for me, it's the number one thing that I have excess clutter on. I have more books than I'll ever read. How would you approach it?
I mean, I'm very honest in the book that like books are my clutter kryptonite. You know, I have so many books, but none of them are clutter to me. I don't feel weighed down by them. Maybe my husband would say something different, but he's not here. I guess the first layer of book clutter is like the stuff that you know you're not going to read, like, you know, outdated diet books or like faddy recipe books. Or the one thing that I find in a lot of my clients' houses is like Booker Prize winners from like 2005 that they bought out of like some sort of intellectual guilt that they probably won't read, you know, that are like not the book that they're really going to go to read.
But that's so, an ego thing as well. It's like, yeah, someone comes into my house and sees The God of Small Things on my shelf.
Totally. And yeah, they're like, oh, they've read that. Okay, yeah, they're this kind of person. Oh, totally. And like, the first thing I look at in a new house that I'm in is their bookshelf. And I love judging people for what they have on their bookshelves. Not judging, but just like,
yeah,
I love asking them about it. You know, yeah, like I love a bookshelf and I get distracted. You know, some people get distracted if a television is on. If there's a bookshelf in a room, I'm just like, what is going on here? your books really represent you. And I definitely keep books that I read as a younger person that now I am a big rereader. So I probably will reread them again, but that represent a stage in my intellectual development or whatever that has a lot of meaning to me. And that's okay. Like, so Jamie, you say you have a lot of books. What about it bothers you? Like,
well, I lived in an apartment on the second floor and I moved in with my partner, and that really bothered me, having to lift probably 500 books downstairs.
Okay.
So I'm so literally like, I said to my partner, like, yeah,
physicality problem.
Yeah, literally. I'm actually, I love them to bits, but I've told John we can never break up because I will never do that again. Ever. They are there for good.
I feel the same thing. I moved in October and moving the books was traumatic. Yeah, it was. And like, I still have a half a bookshelf of books that belong to me in my childhood home, in my parents' home. And I'm like, oh, they can stay there for the moment. They can't bring them in here. But like I said, once they're in your apartment, you're happy to have them, right?
I do love them.
Okay, I'm trying to think of some actual advice I can give. You know, some people have a one in, one out situation. Mm. That's useful. I've never done that myself because I don't feel like I have too many. I would also like to say some people come after Marie Kondo for this. They say like, oh, she has said you can only have 30 books. And I would like to defend Marie because she didn't say that. She said she personally has a limit of 30 books, but she says if you're a book lover, there's no limit.
Yeah.
People love coming after her for loads of things, but anyway, and often the discourse around her is quite racist, I think. You know, she's coming from like a very deep Shinto spiritual practice that gets translated into like cutesy vocab for us, you know, spark joy, like that means something very deep to her. And anyway, I talk a little bit about that in the book, like trying to contextualize her a bit. So yeah, my advice is get rid of any of the stuff that, like, you know, old manuals that are out of date, the information that you could get online now, get rid of those. Old travel books that are out of date. Listen, if you love them, that's
You're
fine.
You're so right, though.
There is no hard and fast rule. But like, you know, if it's like, what are the best cafes in Pisa in 2005? Maybe.
I could probably tell you. It's true. I have all my Lonely Planets. I don't know. Yeah.
And this is hard because some, you know, people come to me all the time on my Instagram for where can I dispose of these things sustainably. That's a big part of my work as well. And those kind of things, you kind of have to just recycle them. And, you know, there's something called the endowment effect. Once it's in the home and you own it, you've paid for it, you've made that transaction, its value for you increases even past the point of rationality, past the point of your own need. So I talk about these things to try and empower people to kind of take control and not be kind of, I don't know, trapped in these psychological traps. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also, you know, as humans, we adapt so easily to our surroundings. So that's why, you know, that bag of clutter in the hall that annoyed us for a week then suddenly becomes part of the decor. And that's just our, you know, our natural kind of mammalian adaptation to our surroundings. And like I said, you know, as long as the stuff isn't bothering you, it's probably not clutter. But if you are like, oh, space is an issue, try and see, what am I just so used to seeing that I actually don't need?
Speaking of like the ideal scenario, you mention a town in the book, Eskilstuna in Sweden. Can you talk a bit about that? But I mean, I don't think people listening will have heard of this. And it sounds like I would love to go to that mall. I love an old bargain. I love an old rummage through things.
It's honestly my dream holiday destination. And like, but then it's kind of weird to kind of take a flight to go to visit the sustainability hub. So I don't know how I'm going to get there. But yes, so Eskilstuna is a Swedish town and they are a zero waste town. They have this zero waste mall that is beside their extremely progressive recycling plant, and all of the unwanted items from the community go to this mall. It's the world's first fully secondhand mall, and it is like, the place looks so gorgeous. It's not like a kind of a sad dusty charity shop like some of them are. Sorry, no shade to charity shops. Charity shops are brilliant, but you know what I mean. Like some of them can just be a bit musty and like
the smell.
This is like somewhere you would want to spend the afternoon. Like there's like a gorgeous florist, there's like people upcycling furniture, and nothing in the town goes to waste. And they have made this leap where the townspeople are happy to donate their unused items for resale. It's just an amazing system of community that I'm just obsessed with. And like I said, they're beside the town recycling plant. I should say this town, they kind of describe it as like the Sheffield of Sweden. You know, it was like a very industrial town that has now been kind of drained of all young people because the industry has kind of been phased out. So they were kind of in want of something to bring vibrancy to the town. And this has now put them on the map. It's just the most amazing story. They are on Instagram, but their Instagram doesn't really show it. You need to kind of go onto their website. And there's a really good Guardian piece interviewing the woman who set it up. The mall is called Rituna. And let's go to Rituna.
Sounds amazing.
But I do love
in some sort of sustainable canoe or something. Yeah.
Well, there's a load of them up on Dundee.
Yeah, the inflatable kayaks off Adrids. Yeah.
But because you talk a lot about this anti-perfectionism, because that's really crippling, the idea of being in every area, because you talk about it from sort of mental health through to how you treat your house and then obviously being sustainable. And I know myself, because I lived on my own in that apartment where I used to take all the books out of. And I have a slight ADHD thing where I will live in a perfect space where I will like move that vase just like that much that way, because that's perfect then. But now obviously I don't, I'm living with someone. So that kind of way of living, that I'm being challenged and that sort of way of being that.
Yeah.
But what I realized is a house is a living, breathing machine that you functional. It's not a hotel lobby. And
It's not just for Instagram.
Yeah, and actually really that shift in my head, especially through the pandemic, really took the stress out of the whole thing. I'm like, it will never look perfect because it's a living thing, which living things live in, and coats will get thrown on the back of chairs and shoes will be left by the door, and the floor has to get dirty to be worth hoovering.
Maybe you're stressing out saying all those things.
No, I'm not even stressing out. It's been a learning curve. And actually there's you take a lot of stress out of your life if you
go completely. And I love that you address that in the book. And you say that it's like you say, Jamie, the house is a living thing, like that we don't have to, you're going to live in your house and it's okay for your house to look like you lived in it.
Totally. Yeah. What I say is like aim for niche, but lived in, you know, the main thing is like knowing where everything is in your house so you can easily use it, and having it easy to put away for yourself So the tidying is easy. Like, that's what it's about. You know, like,
you know what? I got one of my, it's just such an easy thing and I never even thought about it. Put your navy tights in one box and your black tights in another. I spend so much time going to my husband, is this navy or black?
Oh, nightmare.
Because I was actually...
like, it's so stupid. I'm actually probably going to save, just by doing this, I'll probably save like 2 hours a year or something. So thank you.
You're so welcome.
Do you know what I found really... IKEA did these... I think it was like, this is typical... going through that IKEA, they try and lure you in with all the cheap stuff before you get to the counter.
I have a panic attack when I can't go.
And they have these green lizard boxes, you know, the plastic packs of like, and they have all the green lids on them, which I used to have in the car, and I never used them actually in the kitchen. And what I did is one day I just went into the stationery drawers. I now have all my stationery from like paper clips to things in one of those little green things.
Oh, dream.
And it's a little bit American Psycho, but it really is so satisfying. John is like...
Have you ever seen a photo of Khloe Kardashian's pantry?
No.
She has like an insanely organized pantry. Anyway, just Google it.
Okay.
But yeah, it sounds like, it's not American Psycho. You're just organized. It's
crazy. I'm going to Google that now.
I had a question here, which I thought could be useful because I definitely, we've talked a lot about sustainability and I do want to emphasize to people, if we haven't mentioned it enough, Emma, is the book has lots of practical little tips on kind of different boxes you can put things in and going through room by room, that kind of thing. But let's say you feel your space isn't working for you and you're looking to declutter. Do you have any tips on how to sort of manage it with your partner who maybe feels a bit differently than you do? Or is there any thoughts you'd have around that?
I ask this question genuinely every interview. this question because I think it's a problem for so many people. And in the book, I go through the different organizing personalities that people can have. Mm-hmm. It's not like clear cut, you know, like you can have different personalities and different preferences for each room, you know. But you have to meet halfway. If you want that Marie Kondo, all of the t-shirts folded, and your partner is not going to do that, you're always going to be furious with them. Mm-hmm. So you have to, and it's not out of a laziness, like, they might just not think to even do that or want that. So you have to meet halfway, understand how you both work, you know, how you both use the house and meet halfway. If you're, you know, I get a lot of questions from people who have teenage children being like, how do I get them to? And I'm like, they're teenagers. You just have to accept it. Mm. If you can make the house flow as easily as possible, you know, house flow sounds like a kind of a new age music, but it's actually just how objects flow in the house. And if you find that stuff is building up in a particular area, we call it like a clutter hotspot, maybe try and shift that.
Now, we finished most of our interviews. We ask people for their favourite quote. Now, that could be a quote from the book or something that you, or something that you, an ethos in life. So if you have a favourite quote, that'd be amazing.
Well, I have so many. I'm a quotes fiend. I literally have an entire book of quotes. So I have so many favourites. I'll give you three. Okay, so my favourite is, and one of my most treasured possessions, actually, and it has no monetary value. It is a scrap of paper on which, in my early 20s, I scrawled, "The best way out is always through." And it's from a very depressing Robert Frost poem about a mentally ill relative of his. But anyway, the poem is actually brilliant, worth a read. And it always remained in a desk drawer in my parents' house. And I returned there when I would go into a bad depression and would have to kind of, you know, grind my life to a halt once again. I still treasure it so much because I really feel that, like, you have to feel everything that you're feeling. The best way out is always through. It counts for mental health. It counts for grief. It counts for decluttering. It counts for everything. So I love that one. My other favorite is a favorite of the decluttering community, which is a quote from William Morris, who was a British artist, part of the arts and crafts movement, you know, like Liberty Prince and like arts and crafts kind of style. Yeah. Anyway, he's one of the guys from that. And his quote is, "Have a thing in your house that you do not believe to be useful or think to be beautiful." So that's how I try to live. And the third one I'll give you is, we don't need, you know, a small handful of people doing sustainability perfectly. We need all of us doing it imperfectly.
Oh, that was a great quote in the book.
Sorry, you only asked for one.
No, because funny enough, in the book, I had that line, because I think as well, sometimes with myself and probably everyone else, it's like, it just seems so overwhelmingly big that you just end up doing nothing.
Which is a real shame. Yeah.
My favorite quote from your book was, "Put it in the attic is not a decision."
And I had one here, which I actually thought was great, was, Clutter is a delayed decision. Mm-hmm. It was great. Yes. Mm-hmm. So
really enjoyed the book, Emma, and there's so much in it. There's so much more than just decluttering. It gives you an insight into why we keep stuff. Really enjoyed it. And
it's not a scolding, like just get rid of all your stuff. It's like understand why you have it and then learn
what can go. Stuff, holistic therapy for stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on. It's been so enjoyable. Thank you so much, Emma.
I loved it too. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jamie, Emma, good luck with your book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Sorry, I bet you to it. You just bet it to our lives.
That's okay.
Are we going to do it, Sarah?
Yeah, we have to do it.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, Emma,
Good luck with the book.
So thank you so much for coming on, Emma. It was amazing. Brilliant. Really enjoyed chatting to you. For those listening, I think our chats went on for over an hour. Yeah. I was trying to cut them down to her. She was amazing. Like, even for the interview, she was great. But actually, for me personally, I was like, loads of little questions.
James asked me a lot of questions.
I know, I was like, free consultation, make the most of it.
She's amazing. Look her up and get the book. It's really, really good.
And just to say, for our next episode, we will be reviewing Listening Still by Anne Griffin. And we have a special guest reviewer with us, Laura King from the book blog, Laura Eats Books. Now, if you ever wanted to like feel guilt for the little amount you are reading as a human being.
Yeah, follow Laura.
Follow Laura. She seems to read a book a day. She must be the most well-read person I've ever come across. It's amazing. And she's great. Follow her, actually, because she's great recommendations really for books. So she's going to come in and be the tastemaker for
Anne Griffin. And I know Anne Griffin's last book, When All Is Said, was like hugely popular.
She won Irish Newcomer of the Year at the Irish Book Awards and like sold tens of thousands of copies of it. So it can't wait to ever read.
Yeah,
hugely
really
anticipated book.
Can I just say, did you know this? I never knew this. Because you know that program that I told you that the bowl type,
about
the girls in New York. So when they get a salad, when you eat out, you know, you get a salad and it comes in the plastic bowl with the plastic lid.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so I would always like take the lid off and then have this difficulty kind of trying to get the dressing on it.
Yes.
So you pour the dressing on, put the lid on and shake it.
Which makes total sense.
Did you ever do that?
You'd think in the 4 years as a rep, I'd have figured that out.
I know. When they were doing it, I was like, my mind is blown.
Well, especially because if you pour it over, it ends up just being clumps of it in specific places and half it's like dry lettuce.
Yeah.
That makes total sense.
So you pour it. Lid back on, shake.
Amazing.
Perfect. I know.
That makes total sense.
So what's yours? Can you just say?
Can I just say?
Oh, Jamie, sounds like it's going to be a big one.
Okay. Funny enough, I'm looking down my list of can I just say, and there's about eight of them. So clearly there's a lot going on in my life. There. My can I just say is just turning to a big moan fest, but it is what it is. So I have a major issue and I put it down to chains of cafes. When you get a tea in a cafe and they put the tea bag in the cup instead of giving you a pot and you take the tea bag out and the water is about a third of the way down the cup, so you actually have nearly half a cup of tea. I have to say that drives me absolutely mad, and one of the reasons I don't order tea in kind of Costa, or also they don't use Barry's tea, so there's just no end to the misery. I'm paying £3.50 for this tea. Give me a little teapot.
Yeah.
I find it
doesn't leak.
Oh yeah, and you pour it out of the pot and it goes everywhere. Like, you just have to make tea at home. You'd think something where it's put water in pot, put tea bag in pot. Like, the recipe couldn't be simpler. Like, it's a very, very, very plain page in a recipe book. And yet nobody can do it right. Speaking of which, I can tie this back to literature. There is an amazing, amazing reading of a short story. It's a children's short story. It was for Jack and Nori, which was a BBC show years ago, read by Kenneth Williams. You know the guy from The Carry-Ons, the real camp kind of voice? Yeah. He reads it and it's called The Dribblesome Teapot. And from Sip So Sweetly, The Kingdom of Sip So Sweetly. And it's probably the funniest book for kids that I've read that isn't a Roald Dahl. Like,
really?
I've listened to it. It's actually on YouTube, I think. It's brilliant. It's absolutely hysterically funny.
I will, absolutely.
I'm going to put that link in our bio.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm going to look that up.
Oh, you'll love it. I mean, if Pearl and Nancy were probably 3 or 4 years older, like even 6 or 7, I think they'd be properly giggling. It's very, very good. Oh, actually, do you know what? I even have a nicer, can I just say? And I'll just run this in very quickly. Oh. So I was chatting to my sister on Zoom last week, and she lives abroad, and my niece was there as well. And we were talking about kids' books, and I was able to send, because I had some of our family kids' books from when we were young, which had come from families who when we were young. And so I sent a bunch of them over to my niece and then our little family heirloom. So one was, the reason why I kept it was I used to love Naughty Amelia Jane, you know, the Enid Blyton's about the
doll. Enid Blyton, yeah.
Yeah, about the doll who was just awful, actually. She was an awful character. So I was able to send that on to my niece in the post. And also
The Mary Naughtiest Poppins. Girl in School, did you have them?
No, I didn't have them. But they, Enid Blyton as well.
Yeah.
God, she wrote everything, didn't she?
Yeah. Can you think about it? It's like children, it's about kids in boarding school and they're like 6 or 7 or something. God, it's very sad, really.
Oh, God, you're right.
But she was horrible. She was spoiled. Well, she wasn't horrible. She was obviously just desperately sad because her parents had boarding school.
Well, the one I remember about Naughty Amelia Jane was she gets the soap from the bathroom and she wets it and she ties it to the bottom of her shoes so that she can skate up the hallway on the wooden floors. And I just thought that was the best thing. I was dying to do it.
And did you? With your bar of looks?
Palm olive. Never did. Because actually, funny, we had carpeted hallways, so it probably wasn't going to work. But
I know.
I just thought that was the best thing ever. My imagination.
No parquet flooring.
No parquet flooring. And the other one I gave her as well was the Mary Poppins, which is an absolute delight of a book. Oh, it's so,
I never actually read Mary Poppins, the real, Jane
actually
Travers, isn't it?
Better than the film. There's so much in the film that they just left out, like other characters and stuff that were in it that are just brilliant. Moving swiftly on, our coffee and a quote. Do you have your quote to hand? This now, I'm going to say to our viewers, every single episode, Sarah hasn't come up with her quote. And I have to sit here for 5 minutes, which I delete from listening so you guys don't have to listen to it. But I have to sit here and twiddle my thumbs because Sarah had one job to do.
I know, but today, in fairness, we were recording earlier than...
than usual.
Yeah, I'm trying desperately here.
Well, do you know what? I'll do my one because it's short and brief and to the point, and it's actually tied into Stuff Happens, the Emma Gleeson book. It's a quote by Vivian Westwood: "Buy less, choose well, make it last." Great motto. Oh, do you know what? I actually fair dues to her as somebody who has a fashion brand who could be just saying, you know, so pushing capitalists.
So who said it?
Vivian Westwood.
Oh.
Yeah. Do you know what? She's a really principled person. I mean, watch interviews with her. She's an amazing human being and she's not at all been sucked in by the lure of making money. So, and see, Sarah hasn't reacted at all to me giving you this amazing quote. And do you know why? Because she's looking for her quote.
No, I do love that quote from Vivian Westwood.
Yeah.
For so I have this amazing quote that I totally came up with myself and had ready to go. Too many people spend money they haven't earned to buy things they don't want, to impress people they don't like.
Which sums up modern life.
Isn't it? Yeah.
No, we've such a moment right now with the pandemic. We've all been, well, I certainly have, maybe not everyone. I know people are online shopping like mad, but I've cut out a lot of spending habits that kind of wandering aimlessly and buying another 5 black and white extra small t-shirts. Like, I just don't see myself needing to go into a shop for a while when everything reopens because I have all the clothes I haven't worn for a year and I'm suddenly excited about wearing them again. So, which is great.
It is exciting.
Though I think skinny trousers seem to be coming out. They're trying to make baggy trousers come back in.
No.
Yeah. And
they're not. Like,
see, we've been there. We've been burnt.
Yeah. And like the drag along the ground trousers and pick up all the dirt.
That's all going to come back. There's a generation who have grown up without knowing
that. We won't wear them. We're too old.
I know.
That's the thing. That's sad, isn't it?
But people look at us now wearing skinny jeans going like, they're disgusting.
But Jamie, we keep the skinny jeans on because you don't want to be buying something to impress somebody you don't like. Wear what
that's
you're comfortable
very true.
In.
Yeah. I might end up just having to be like a kind of a slim. I'll get rid of the, I'll get rid of the super skinny. So.
Do you have super skinny? I wouldn't have.
I'm fairly fitting. Jeans. I wouldn't have like, do you know Cheap Mondays and stuff like that where they're like they're literally leggings on? No, I wouldn't have anything like that. But I did the 5 or 6 years of wearing baggy pants and the like scooping up the detritus of the street, like in my
I know.
Pants. And then the back would be all ripped and frayed and wet on a, like, Ireland isn't made to have trousers drag on the ground. It's way too wet.
Grotesque.
However, that's been our journey and we've learned that lesson. Like, we can't deny the youth of today who don't know anything about what we went through. They're right.
But you don't think skinny jeans look better? I think they look way better.
Oh yeah, definitely, like the shape of your leg. Yeah. Like, if you've got good legs, skinny jeans are amazing. Like, they're great. I definitely think they're much more flattering.
Yeah, much more flattering than just like baggy.
But like, boot cut is quite flattering as well because it lengthens your leg a bit, I suppose, it goes down to your shoe. But I'm just, I feel a bit, I've had all the boot cut I can have.
Boot cut just says.
No, but it was the thing, late 90s, we all had boot cut.
I know.
But the other thing that's coming back is middle partings. It's a trend on TikTok about it. And I'm just like, I just feel I need to post a picture of me with a middle parting from about 2000, just so the youth can know this is what it actually looks like.
Oh. Find it, get it out, rid it out. Dara had one too.
Oh, it's just, it doesn't work. So
undercut, do you have an undercut?
Yes, step, kind of undercut, yeah. And greasy, what's it, shockwaves gel, slick down, middle parting, the whole lot, squirting big lumps of it into your hair. Okay.
Rub it in.
As always, before we finish, if you can pass the pod.
Pass the pod. Rate and review, 5 stars.
That'd be amazing. And as always, whatever you're reading,
whatever you're writing,
good luck with the book.